You're listening to Office Hours, a series of curious conversations with Belfer Center experts. We sat down with Richard Zeckhauser, the Frank P. Ramsey Professor of Political Economy at the Harvard Kennedy School. You like to play cards?
I do.
Sure. Are you more of a go fish professor or a rummy professor? What do you like to play?
A lot of my students say I'm a rummy professor, but I'm actually a bridge player.
You're a bridge player?
Yes.
What do you like about bridge so much?
I think the most interesting thing about bridge is it's a partnership game, and you have to cooperate with another person over a long period of time and meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. That's not my quote, that's from somebody else.
So, isn't bridge, didn't Warren Buffett say bridge is the best preparation for business? Is that him?
That was Warren Buffett, yes.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that completely. One of the things about bridge is you always have to think about things in probabilistic terms. The probabilities are very rarely well-defined. You have to try and draw inferences from what other people are doing, including things that you've never seen before. And I believe that's very much the same thing in business.
And is it just for business, or do you think you can learn from bridge in other domains as well, other professions?
I think you learn it for other professions. I mean, I presume we're talking about international security here today. I began my career, and indeed the reason I'm an economist, mm-hmm. is that I began in international security. I was working for the Whiz Kids in the Defense Department in the 1960s. And at the end of my first summer there, my boss, a man named Alan Endhoven, said, "What are you doing next year?" And I said, "I'm going into business." I didn't say because Warren Buffett's going to say bridge is the best preparation. And he said, "Why don't you become an economist?" So I went off and I became an economist. But I always thought that what I learned about bridge helped me think about problems of deception and deterrence and cooperation with allies and all the types of things that come up if you're a, you know, games player. There's one major difference, which is that bridge is played for fun, mm-hmm. and bridge is a zero-sum game. If you and I are partners, what we win, the people on the other side of the table lose. Whereas in international security, as Tom Schelling used to observe, the people with whom we have the most cooperative interest is the Soviet Union, who at that point in the 60s, 70s, 80s, up until 1990, we could have destroyed each other, and we had a mutual interest in avoiding nuclear war.
I'd love to talk about Tom Schelling a little bit. Tom Schelling, who was your advisor, PhD advisor,
And my undergraduate advisor. Tom Schelling, who's 94 years old, I still visit him regularly in Washington, and he's just as creative a thinker as he was when I was 18 when I met him.
And he wrote a classic, Micro Motives and Macro Behavior. A lot of people today probably are more familiar with Freakonomics, but this was the classic. This is what started a field. What is that book about, and are there things that we can draw from that book today that we can apply it to?
Well, the theme of micromotives and macrobehavior is that there are many individual decision units, yeah. all of whom are making decisions in their own self-interest, and frequently that leads to an outcome that's highly inefficient. An example that he gives, which is very dramatic in its implications, is that you're driving along the Southeast Expressway, and there's a terrible traffic jam. And it takes you a half an hour until you get up to a point where the congestion seems to be concentrated, and you see that there's a mattress on the side of the road. And you turn to your companion and sort of say, "That's really interesting, there's a mattress on the side of the road." And you spend 8 seconds looking at the mattress, and then you're holding up the 400 cars behind you for 8 seconds each. So you're holding things up for 3,200 seconds or 50 minutes, just your own
time.
Looking at this, 8 seconds. And I think that, although it wasn't in the book, because fortunately it hadn't been invented yet, but if you look at ISIS and its recruitment strategies, it's responding to or is trying to influence the micromotives of lots of individuals around the world. And although what ISIS is doing is repelling, you know, 99% of the people in the world, including the Muslim population, its ability to attract 1% of the people due to their personal micromotives for whatever reason turns out to be very effective for them.
What do you mean by micromotives? How are those just different from regular motives?
Well, I think that Tom Schelling was looking at an aggregate. And he said if you look at the aggregate, he would call that a macromotive. And micromotives are just what affects, you know, one individual, or it could be one, you know, microorganism within your body. He would be interested in that as well. And he, of course, applied this to many other areas. He applied this to, for example, problems of racial tipping in neighborhoods, which is my neighborhood. I'm a white person. My neighborhood is now 30% black. I would like it to stay 30% black. But unfortunately, you sell your home and a black person moves in and now it's 31% black. And that's just a little bit higher than what I would like. So I sell my home and now it's 32% black. And eventually we get the whole process to tip. And everybody might have originally preferred that we have a stable neighborhood. Let me just mention another book that Tom Schelling wrote, which is a book called The Strategy of Conflict, which was a book which pointed out the observation that I made earlier about how people who think of themselves as having opposed interests, as did the United States and the Soviet Union, now have actually had very much united interests, which I think is also relevant to many current security problems. If you think of fighting ISIS, there are very few people in the American policy establishment or defense establishment who have much affection for Russia or President Putin. But to some extent in that conflict, he's sort of on our side. So we were upset today to learn that he's putting missile defense systems into Syria, which could cause conflagrations with our NATO ally, Turkey. But if you think that ISIS is a bigger problem than Mr. Assad, as I do, maybe we have to get together with him. The other point that I would just observe, and as you and I discussed in our class that we do together, coalitions are very unstable, and people have asked me in the last few days, do you think we should be cooperating with Russia in any way? And I said, in World War II, there was a man who was, in my view, worse than Putin, named Stalin. And when Hitler double-crossed Stalin, we allied with Stalin, I think very much to the ultimate benefit of the world, though he was about as bad a person as you could identify, though not as bad as Hitler.
You study risk assessment threats and things like that, behavioral decision-making. What are the greatest threats America faces? Is ISIS one of those? Are we inflating it? Are we not?
Well, you know, as ISIS stands today, the answer is no. But you always want to know what's a little threat that could turn into a grave threat. When I was a young man, my mother used to remind me that Calvin Coolidge's son died from an infected tennis blister. Okay, so you get a tennis blister. Yeah, you pick the blister, it's sort of painful. I think that in its potential, ISIS is, you know, an extraordinary threat. How I would compare that to the threat of the spread of nuclear weapons, how I would compare that to the threat of pandemics, which killed somewhere between 50 and 100 million people roughly 100 years ago when we had a flu epidemic in 1918. You know, I don't really know, but well, it's a big enough threat to worry about.
You also, you've written, you had an article co-wrote an article about recollection bias, where if we've experienced something, we tend to prioritize that as a probability. In assessing the threat of ISIS, are people doing that? Are they fearing it too much because of what 9/11 happened, or say because of witnessing what happened in France, that we assume that the probabilities are greater?
Well, I mean, the major lesson from all the research that I've seen on probabilities, including what I've done myself, is how do humans process probabilities? Terribly. We're really, really poor at it. And unfortunately, most of the major decisions that we make, certainly in the policy sphere, in the international security sphere, involve probabilities. But people, when they can recollect something that they've experienced before and it's salient in their mind, they assign too high a probability to that going into the future. It's called the availability heuristic. And people also tend to think that when bad things have happened, they had a surprising bad thing happens, they assigned a much higher probability to it before than they actually did. So most people think that they anticipated, or that 9/11 much more than we did. And we actually went and looked at the data as to how often the New York Times talked about terrorism before that, particular event. And the answer was hardly at all.
Why is
we
that?
Weren't worried.
Is that
because
we were
sure in the anticipation there was the view that terrorism does not happen on American soil. And we have occasional crazy people like the guy who bombed the Oklahoma City building. but we don't have to worry about it internationally. So if we haven't experienced something, we don't think it's going to happen. You tell a person who's my age and is out of shape that you have a realistic chance of, a significant chance of a heart attack in the next year, they don't believe you. After they have a heart attack, then they sort of say, I always knew that I was at a significant risk.
Something natural that we do.
It's just a natural thing that we do. Maybe it's a way to enable us to get through life because, in the old days when there were, wild animals about that could kill you and eat you, going through life was just too hard. So you didn't anticipate all these terrible things that could happen to you. And one of the things that we discussed in class is that optimists who have very unrealistic assessments about their abilities and about the risks in life do better in life because they get up and they go out and they do things. So there's a selective advantage to sort of suppress these things. But when you're a professional who's supposed to worry about what's the likelihood that ISIS will launch a major terrorist attack in the United States, or what's the likelihood that nuclear weapons will spread from this country to that country, I think it's your job to be realistic rather than optimistic.
What do you mean optimists do better than pessimists? In what way? They live longer?
They live longer. If you go and you round up the people in your community who are earning more than $100,000 and then you test them on optimism, they will be more optimistic than the people in your community who earn $40,000 a year. And I think the best test for optimism, which I like because it's connected to virtually nothing else, is you ask people, how far can you standing broad jump? So you draw a line on the floor, and you sort of say, where do you think you can jump to? And then you show where they say they can jump to. And optimists draw a line that's too far. Pessimists draw a line that's too far, but not nearly as far. And the only people who draw a realistic line are the depressives.
Are the depressed people?
The depressed people. It's not great, depression is terrible, so it's not great to be depressed. But the one thing you do know is how far you can standing broad jump.
What's the difference between that and overconfidence and insecurity? See, that seems to me that the people
Overconfidence is goes along with optimism, I think. Overconfidence means that when you assess the likelihood of things, you're too likely to assume that you know more than you do. So we like to run surveys where we ask people how many people live in Poland, what's the distance from Jakarta to Sydney, how much steel was produced in the United Kingdom in 2014. And then we say, okay, give us your best estimate, and then give us your first percentile, a number that is 1% likely to be less than that, and your 99th percentile, 1% likely to be more than that. Now, we're not asking that people know how much steel is produced in England, but we do expect them to know that they really don't know. So they should have very broad bands. But in fact, what people do is they tend to have much narrower bands than are justified given their state of knowledge. So when you go out and you're going to start a new business, or you're going to get your graduate degree, or almost anything else you're going to do, you're overconfident about what you know about the future. People are also optimistic about how easy it is to complete a project. As I remember, you're a PhD student, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
What year are you in your PhD program?
My second year.
Your second year. Well, you're probably sort of saying, I think I can really get through my thesis in another 2 years. Now, that's possible, but in my 40 years of directing theses, I've seen three people complete their theses in 4 years. The norm is 5 years, and I've seen 25 people complete their theses in 6 years. So many more fall short of the norm than exceed the norm. But of course, Arup, we know that you're different.
That's right. I mean, I could be one of those three.
You could be one. No, then there'd be four, which is
right.
What I'm devoutly hoping for.
But you're also saying that it's good to be overconfident because it helps that individual more. So if that means invading Iraq and think we have a better chance of a quicker war. I mean, you're kind of, it almost seems
I'm being inconsistent. Okay.
Yeah, it feels inconsistent.
So let me give you the example using your thesis in the invasion of Iraq.
I love this.
Okay. On your thesis, it's good that you think you're going to be able to finish it on time, because then you go and you work very hard and you stay in graduate school and you take on bigger ideas and you write a better thesis.
Okay.
And if you were really pessimistic, you might just quit and go off and become a Wall Street trader. As I think I remarked a few minutes ago, when you're in a professional position where you're risking thousands of American lives and you're risking disrupting an entire society for decades, I think you have a responsibility to be realistic and recognize that when we did, that invasions always are not, the invasion itself wasn't hard in Iraq. It was trying to reform the country and reform the government. And that's a exceedingly difficult thing to do. And I hope that America will have discovered by now, having kicked out Saddam Hussein, a bad man, and having helped to kick out Mr. Gaddafi, a bad man, that when you kick out bad guys, you frequently get something that's worse. And we should just learn from our experience. The other notion is the people who are all sitting around, it's sort of a groupthink. And I believe that the people who invaded Iraq, there weren't people there who were saying, at the table, there were certainly people in the society who were saying, what are the really strong reasons why this invasion will not work? And that's where you, by not having someone who's sort of whose responsibility it is to point out the flaws in your plan, you're likely to take on endeavors that don't make much sense, such as invading Iraq.
Well, on the theme of military force, you are working on a paper at the moment. You're saying that the Air Force is about to make a big boo-boo and waste a lot of money with the acquisition of some new aircraft, fighter jets.
Right.
What's that about?
I had a terrific student a couple of years ago named John Green, who's Navy SEAL. He was the leader of SEAL Team 7. And he fought in Afghanistan and led 180 or 190 missions. And he said that his the life of himself and his force were frequently saved by having close air support, which was differentially provided by a plane called the A-10, the Warthog, which is a plane that's now 30 years old. It's called the Warthog for two reasons. One is its guns are canted down, so they look like tusks of Warthog. The other is this fairly ugly plane. The plane that the Air Force has proposed replacing the A-10 and other planes as well is called the F-35, which is a super sophisticated jet fighter.
Stealth, right?
Stealth fighter.
Yeah.
It will be terrific if we have to fight the Chinese or the Russians or any other advanced nation in a conventional war. But we haven't had a conventional war since the Korean War. We have lots of wars against terrorists, against insurgents and the like, as we did in Afghanistan, as we do in Iraq and in Syria. If we have to confront Boko Haram, if we have to confront drug people in South America, these will all be wars against irregular forces. It turns out that the Warthog is terrific at close air support. It's clad in titanium, so it can survive ground fire, including from cannons. It's slow, so it can loiter over an airfield forever, or not forever, but for a much longer time than an F-35. The pilot can look out of the cockpit pit and see the ground, which is very important when you're fighting in a regular war, because the one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to kill people in the local civilian population, which turns them against you. I actually climbed into the cockpit of an A-10, and it was...
Felt good, yeah.
Well, the exterior of the plane was beautiful, even though it was 30 years old. The interior of the cockpit looked like an old cockpit.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the leather was worn.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to let pilots sit there. The pilots of A-10s love the A-10. Our stealth fighter, the F-35, is extraordinarily poorly equipped for this. It can turn on a dime. It can, you can't see it with radar. But our opponents don't, in these insurgent wars, generally don't have radar. It's very vulnerable to ground fire. Its guns are aimed forward so that it can shoot down the enemy airplane rather than being, you know, shooting at the ground. You cannot see the ground well from the cockpit. I mean, on virtually every dimension, it's, for this purpose, it's worse than the A-10. Now, the other difference, of course, is we have a large fleet of A-10s.
Yeah.
And they've been refurbished so that they'll last for another 20 years. And the cost of an F-35 is about $160 million. I'm not proposing that we replace the entire force of F-35s with A-10s, but I would like to replace, preserve, our 180 plus A-10s that have already been refurbished and purchase 10% fewer F-35s. Even if we could save the money, let's assume you said somehow or other we found a miraculous way to, well, to save money on energy. The Air Force uses a lot of fuel.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to spend that on the F-35s, of which we're going to have about 1,900.
Sure.
Let's have 1,700 and at least have something that's going to be able to provide us with close air support. I see no future in which we're not going to have to be in fighting insurgents in 10 years. Who they will be and where they will be from, I don't know. But even when we get involved in conflicts with Russia in the eastern Ukraine, no, we're dealing with insurgents. We're not dealing with Russian troops. By the way, I should point out that John Green is, a co-author on this paper, indeed. And this is not just his opinion from having been in conflicts in Afghanistan. We spoke to the tactical Air Force controllers, and we did a survey of all of them, and we asked them about what characteristics should be used, how important they were, and we did a Alan Enthoven, who was my boss back in the Defense Department, would say, a very conscientious job of comparing these two weapon systems.
I want to switch gears a little bit.
Fine.
Talk about food.
Food.
Yeah.
As you can see, I'm not bad on food, or at least I consume a lot of it.
You study risk assessment, and it's always in the news is about what's good for us and what's good to eat, and you know, what gives us cancer, what might give, help us live longer. And word on the street is that you're a big fan of salmon. Salmon is something you eat. Now, is that because of your work and research that you've thought about these things in a very specific way, you figured out salmon is the right thing, or is that just sort of tastes like Reese's peanut butter cups to you? Do you really enjoy it?
No, I actually think I would prefer to eat Reese's peanut butter cups.
They're the best.
To salmon. But salmon really is good for you. I haven't done any research on salmon per se, but I've read quite a few articles which talk about the importance of omega-3 fish oils, and salmon has a lot of them. So I try and eat it. There are lots of things that you should avoid eating, but I think that one of the things that we can do a better job of is telling which ones are really important to avoid and which ones are only a little bit important to avoid.
I just found out that peanut butter and bacon cause cancer.
Right. I mean, yeah. Bacon is pretty bad for you. But we should have some, you know, vague sense of what's relative risk levels are. I mean, bacon relative to smoking is trivial. Peanut butter has usually escaped regulation because its cancer-causing elements are aflatoxins, which are a naturally occurring substance, which are in peanuts. And eating raw peanuts is particularly bad for you because the aflatoxins tend to reside inside that little layer that covers the peanut. So eat peanuts at baseball games if you don't go to too many baseball games a year.
But don't
have them every day.
Okay.
And by the way, just so that you don't, I just finished a study where we looked at the FDA's warning about mercury in seafood. And the analysis that people have done of this is that this was probably a net negative warning for most of the population, because people are bad at distinguishing between seafoods that have a lot of mercury, such as swordfish, and seafoods which have little mercury, such as salmon, and they gave up their salmon along with their swordfish. And if the reduction in salmon is great relative to the reduction in swordfish, you've made people worse off, not better off.
Do you ever tell lies?
I really, really rarely tell lies. I occasionally will tell a white lie, because you can really say it's better that I do that. So I can sort of say, Arup, thank you. That was a really good interview. I would consider that to be a white lie.
Okay.
But you're probably getting at the idea of paltering, which is one of my favorite subjects. And I believe that we all palter a great deal. Now, palter, which is a word which is spelled P-A-L-T-E-R, in itself is a great palter. Paltering is trying to mislead people without lying.
So what is it? It seems to me that you can either tell the truth or you can tell a lie.
I think there are many, many shades of gray.
Like for example...
Well, so, for example, if you want to ask me, how's my academic career going?
Yes.
And let's assume, fortunately this isn't true, that I've just had three papers rejected by a journal, but I had a paper accepted by another journal before those three. And I could say... Well, actually, I just had a paper accepted by the American Journal of Health Economics. Now, that's true, but I've only given you some of the information. Mm. I didn't say I had a paper accepted in the American Journal of Health Economics, but I had a paper rejected by International Security, and I had a paper rejected by the Journal of Political Economy, and I had a paper rejected by the American Economic Review. Virtually every one of us, when we draw up our resume, we palter to some extent. So we think, what should we include on our resume that's going to impress people the most? Let me give you a palter.
Sure.
Right. If you ask me what paper was my most interesting paper that I worked on yesterday, I would mention the paper that I was writing on Raphael, the Renaissance painter. And this is actually true. I was working on this paper. I'm writing it with my collaborator, Jonathan Nelson, who's a Renaissance art expert. I suspect that I could compete with you in my lack of knowledge of Raphael. However, we're writing the article, and I'm supposed to do the economics, and he's supposed to do the art history. And I can easily sort of say, I was actually writing about Raphael yesterday.
It gives me the impression that you know.
That I know, and that I would recognize. My co-author would recognize, you know, 100 different paintings by Raphael and could tell you a lot about them. I would recognize all 5 of the paintings by Raphael that we talked about yesterday.
Does everybody palter? Do most people palter?
I think that Mother Teresa didn't palter. But I think that almost everybody palters. By the way, I'm not sure Mother Teresa didn't palter.
I've met Mother Teresa.
What?
Twice.
Yeah, did she palter with you?
No. She just blessed me twice.
She blessed you. Okay. Well, then.
Are you surprised?
Then she didn't. Palter at all. But no, I think that almost everybody palters to some extent. I think almost every person who prepares a resume palters a little bit. My guess is that if I asked people about you, you'd be more likely to tell me about yourself. You'd be more likely to tell them that you were a Harvard student. Then you would tell them that actually I'm sloppy in keeping up my apartment. But if I asked you're married?
I'm not.
Yeah. If I asked your roommate about you, what can you tell me about a roommate? He'd sort of say, boy, is he a messy roommate. He wouldn't say you went to Harvard.
Well, my roommate happens to be my brother, so maybe he would palter a little bit.
No, he would probably tell me the truth, is my guess.
That's true.
Your brother is a very honest guy, I'm sure.
Professor Zeckhauser, thank you so much for joining us today. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. It was a terrific interview. Yeah. Thanks very much, Arun.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.